Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you.
Tony and the Beatles
by Philip K. Dick.
Reddish-yellow sunlight filtered through the thick quartz windows into the sleep compartment. Tony Rossi yawned, stirred a little, then opened his black eyes and sat up quickly. With one motion, he tossed the covers back and slid to the warm metal floor. He clicked off his alarm clock and hurried to the closet. It looked like a nice day. The landscape outside was motionless, undisturbed by winds or dust shift. The boy's heart pounded excitedly. He pulled his trousers on, zipped up the reinforced mesh, struggled into his heavy canvas shirt, and then sat down on the edge of the cot to tug on his boots. He closed the seams around their tops and then did the same with his gloves. Next, he adjusted the pressure on his pump unit and strapped it between his shoulder blades. He grabbed his helmet from the dresser, and he was ready for the day. In the dining compartment, his mother and father had finished breakfast. Their voices drifted to him as he clattered down the ramp. A disturbed murmur. He paused to listen. What were they talking about? Had he done something wrong again? And then he caught it. Behind their voices was another voice, static and crackling pops, the all-system audio signal from Rigel 4. They had it turned up full blast. The dull thunder of the monitor's voice boomed loudly. The war. Always the war, he sighed and stepped out into the dining compartment. Morning, his father muttered. Good morning, dear, his mother said absently. She sat with her head turned to one side, wrinkles of concentration webbing her forehead. Her thin lips were drawn together in a tight line of concern. His father had pushed his dirty dishes back and was smoking, elbows on the table, dark, hairy arms bare and muscular. He was scowling, intent on the jumbled roar from the speaker above the sink. "How's it going?" Tony asked. He slid into his chair and reached automatically for the ersatz grapefruit. Any news from Orion? Neither of them answered. They didn't hear him. He began to eat his grapefruit. Outside, beyond the little metal and plastic housing unit, sounds of activity grew. Shouts and muffled crashes as rural merchants in their trucks rumbled along the highway toward Carnet. The reddish daylight swelled. Betelgeuse was rising quietly and majestically. Nice day, Tony said. No flux wind. I think I'll go down to the end quarter a while. We're building a neat spaceport. A model, of course, but we've been able to get enough materials to lay out strips for. With a savage snarl, his father reached out and struck the audio. Roar immediately died. I knew it. He got up and moved angrily away from the table. I told them it would happen. They shouldn't have moved so soon. Should have built up Class A supply bases first. Isn't our main fleet moving in from Bellatrix? Tony's mother fluttered anxiously. According to last night's summary, the worst that can happen, Orion 9 and 10 will be dumped. Joseph Rossi laughed harshly. The hell with last night's summary. They know as well as I do what's happening. What's happening? Tony echoed as he pushed aside his grapefruit and began to ladle out dry cereal. Are we losing the battle? Yes, his father's lips twisted. Earthmen losing to beetles. I told them, but they couldn't wait. My God, there's 10 good years left in this system. Why did they have to push out? Everybody knew Orion would be tough. The whole damn beetle fleet strung out around there, waiting for us, and we have to barge right in. But nobody ever thought beetles would fight, Leia Rossi protested mildly. Everybody thought they'd just fire a few blasts, and then they ought to fight. They have to fight. Orion's the last jump-off. If they don't fight here, where the hell can they fight? Rossi swore savagely. Of course they're fighting. We have all their planets except the inner Orion string. Not that they're worth much, but it's the principle of the thing. If we'd built up strong supply bases, we could have broken up Beetle Fleet and really clobbered it. Don't say Beetle, Tony murmured as he finished his cereal. They're Pasudeti, same as here. The word Beetle comes from Belticus, an Arabian word we invented ourselves. Joe Rossi's mouth opened and closed. What are you, a goddamn beetle lover? Joe, Leia snapped. For heaven's sake. Rossi moved toward the door. If I was 10 years younger, I'd be out there. I'd really show those shiny-shelled insects what the hell they're up against. Them and their junky, beat-up old hulks. Converted freighters. His eyes blazed. When I think of them shooting down Terran cruisers with our boys in them, Orion's their system, Tony murmured. Their system? When the hell did you get to be an authority on space law? Why, I ought to... He broke off, choked with rage. My own kid, he muttered. One more crack out of you today, and I'll hang you on one. You'll feel the rest of the week. Tony pushed his chair back. I won't be around here today. I'm going into Carnet with my Eep. Yeah, to play with beetles. Tony said nothing. He was already sliding his helmet in place and snapping the clamps tight. As he pushed through the back door into the lock membrane, he unscrewed his oxygen tap and set the tank filter into action. An automatic response conditioned by a lifetime spent on a colony planet in an alien system. A faint flux wind caught at him and swept yellow-red dust around his boots. Sunlight glittered from the metal roof of his family's housing unit, one of endless rows of squat boxes set in the sandy slope, protected by the line of ore-refining installations against the horizon. He made an impatient signal, and from the storage shed his Eep came gliding out, catching the sunlight on its chrome trim. We're going down into Carnet, Tony said unconsciously, slipping into the past dialect. Hurry up, took up its position behind him, and he started briskly down the slope, over the shifting sand, toward the road. There were quite a few traders out today. It was a good day for the market. Only a fourth of the year was fit for travel. Betelgeuse was an erratic and undependable sun. Not at all like Sol, according to the edutapes, fed to Tony for hours a day, 6 days a week. He had never seen Sol himself. He reached the noisy road. Pasudeti were everywhere, whole groups of them, with their primitive combustion-driven trucks, battered and filthy, motors grinding protestingly. He waved as the trucks, as they pushed past him. After a moment, one slowed down. It was piled with tis, bundled heaps of gray vegetables, dried and prepared for the table, a staple of the Pasudeti diet. Behind the wheel lounged a dark-faced elderly Pas, one arm over the open window, a rolled leaf between his lips. He was like all other Pasudeti, lank and hard-shelled, encased in a brittle sheath in which he lived and died. You want a ride? The Pass murmured. Required protocol when an Earthman on foot was encountered. Is there room for my Eep? The Pass made a careless notion with his claw. It can run behind. Sardonic amusement touched his ugly old face. If it gets to Carnet, we'll sell it for scrap. We can use a few condensers and relay tubing. We're short on electronic maintenance stuff. I know, Tony said solemnly as he climbed into the cabin of the truck. It's all been sent to the big repair base at Orion 1 for your war fleet. Amusement vanished from the leathery face. Yes, the war fleet. He turned away and started up the truck again. In the back, Tony's Eep had scrambled up on the load of Tiss and was gripping precariously with its magnetic lines. Tony noticed the Pasudetti's sudden change of expression, and he was puzzled. He started to speak to him, but now he noticed unusual quietness among the other pass, in the other trucks, behind and in front of his own. The war, of course. It had swept through this system a century ago. These people had been left behind. Now all eyes were on Orion, on the battle between the Terran war fleet and the Pasudetti collection of armed freighters. "Is it true," Tony asked carefully, "that you're winning?" The elderly Puss grunted. "We hear rumors." Tony considered. "My father says Terra went ahead too fast. He says we should have consolidated. We didn't assemble adequate supply bases. He used to be an officer when he was younger. He was with the fleet for 2 years. The Pass was silent a moment. "It's true," he said at last, "that when you're so far from home, supply is a great problem. We, on the other hand, don't have that. We have no distances to cover." "Do you know anybody fighting?" "I have distant relatives." The answer was vague. The Pass obviously didn't want to talk about it. "Have you ever seen your war fleet?" "Not as it exists now. When this system was defeated, most of our units were wiped out. Remnants limped to Orion and joined the Orion fleet." "Your relatives were with the remnants?" "That's right." "Then you were alive when this planet was taken." "Why do you ask?" The old Pass quivered violently. "What business is it of yours?" Tony leaned out and watched the walls and buildings of Carnet grow ahead of them. Carnet was an old city. It had stood thousands of years. The Pasudetti civilization was stable. It had reached a certain point of technocratic development and then leveled off. The Pass had inter-system ships that had carried people and freight between planets in the days before the Terran Confederation. They had combustion-driven cars, audiophones, a power network of a magnetic type. Their plumbing was satisfactory, and their medicine was highly advanced. They had art forms, emotional and exciting. They had a vague religion. "Who do you think will win the battle?" Tony asked. "I don't know." With a sudden jerk, the old Pass brought the truck to a crouching halt. "This is as far as I go. Please get out and take your Eep with you." Tony faltered in surprise. "But aren't you going no farther?" Tony pushed the door open. He was vaguely uneasy. There was a hard, fixed expression on the leathery face, and the old creature's voice had a sharp edge he had never heard before. "Thanks," he murmured. He hopped down into the red dust and signaled his Eep. It released its magnetic lines, and instantly the truck started up with a roar, passing on inside the city. Tony watched it go, still dazed. The hot dust slapped at his ankles. He automatically moved his feet and slapped at his trousers. A truck honked, and his Eep quickly moved him from the road up to the level pedestrian ramp. Pasudetti in swarms moved by, endless lines of rural people hurrying into Carnet on their daily business. A massive public bus had stopped by the gate and was letting off passengers, male and female pass, and children. They laughed and shouted. The sounds of their voices blended with the low hum of the city. "Going in?" A sharp Pasudetti voice sounded close behind him. "Keep moving. You're blocking the ramp." It was a young female with a heavy armload clutched in her claws. Tony felt embarrassed. Female Pass had a certain telepathic ability, part of their sexual makeup. It was effective on Earthmen at close range. Here, she said, give me a hand. Tony nodded his head and the Eep accepted the female's heavy armload. I'm visiting the city, Tony said as they moved with the crowd toward the gates. I got a ride most of the way, but the driver left me out here. You're from the settlement? Yes. She eyed him critically. You've always lived here, haven't you? I was born here. My family came here from Earth 4 years before I was born. My father was an officer in the fleet. He earned an emigration priority. So you've never seen your own planet? How old are you? 10 years, Terran. You shouldn't have asked the driver so many questions. They passed through the decontamination shield and into the city. An information square loomed ahead. Past men and women were packed around it. Moving chutes and transport cars rumbled everywhere. Buildings and ramps and open-air machinery. The city was sealed in a protective dust-proof envelope. Tony unfastened his helmet and clipped it to his belt. The air was stale-smelling, artificial, but usable. Let me tell you something, the young woman said carefully as she strode along the foot ramp beside Tony. I wonder if this is a good day for you to come into Karnit. I know you've been coming here regularly to play with your friends, but perhaps today you ought to stay at home, in your settlement. Why? Because today everybody is upset. I know, Tony said. My mother and father were upset. They were listening to the news from our base in the Rigel system. I don't mean your family. Other people are listening, too. These people here, my race. They're upset, all right, Tony admitted. But I come here all the time. There's nobody to play with at the settlement. And anyhow, we're working on a project. A model spaceport. That's right. Tony was envious. I sure wish I was a telepath. It must be fun. The female Pasudetti was silent. She was deep in thought. What would happen, she asked, if your family left here and returned to Earth? That couldn't happen. There's no room for us on Earth. C-bombs destroyed most of Asia and North America back in the 20th century. Suppose you had to go back. Tony didn't understand. But we can't. Habitable portions of Earth are overcrowded. Our main problem is finding places for Terrans to live in other systems. He added, and anyhow, I don't particularly want to go to Terra. I'm used to it here. All my friends are here. I'll take my packages, the female said. I go this other way, down this third level ramp. Tony nodded to his Eep and it lowered the bundles into the female's claws. She lingered a moment, trying to find the right words. Good luck, she said. With what? She smiled faintly, ironically. With your model spaceport. I hope you and your friends get to finish it. Of course we'll finish it, Tony said, surprised. It's almost done. What does she mean? The Pasudetti woman hurried off before he could ask her. Tony was troubled and uncertain. More doubts filled him. After a moment, he headed slowly into the lane that took him toward the residential section of the city. Past the stores and factories to the place where his friends lived. The group of Pasudetti children eyed him silently as he approached. They had been playing in the shade of an immense hangelo, whose ancient branches drooped and swayed with the air currents pumped through the city. Now they sat unmoving. I didn't expect you today, Biprith said in an expressionless voice. Tony halted awkwardly and his Eep did the same. How are things? He murmured. Fine. I got a ride part way. Fine. Tony squatted down in the shade. None of the past children stirred. They were small, not as large as Terran children. The shells had not hardened, had not turned dark and opaque like horn. It gave them a soft, unformed appearance, but at the same time it lightened their load. They moved more easily than their elders. They could hop and skip around. Still, but they were not skipping right now. "What's the matter?" Tony demanded. "What's wrong with everybody?" No one answered. "Where's the model?" he asked. "Have you fellows been working on it?" After a moment, Liar nodded slightly. Tony felt dull anger rise up inside him. "Say something. What's the matter? What are you all mad about?" "Mad?" Biprith echoed. "We're not mad." Tony scratched aimlessly in the dust. He knew what it was. The war, again. The battle going on near Orion. His anger burst up wildly. "Forget the war. Everything was fine yesterday, before the battle." "Sure," Liar said. "It was fine." Tony caught the edge to his voice. "It happened 100 years ago. It's not my fault." "Sure," Bepritz said. "This is my home, isn't it? Haven't I got as much right here as anybody else? I was born here." "Sure," Liar said tonelessly. Tony appealed to them helplessly. "Do you have to act this way? You didn't act this way yesterday. I was here yesterday. All of us were here yesterday. What's happened since yesterday?" "The battle," Bepritz said. "What difference does that make? What does that change everything? That's always war. There have been battles all the time, as long as I can remember. What's different about this?" Bepritz broke apart a clump of dirt with his strong claws. After a moment, he tossed away and got slowly to his feet. "Well," he said thoughtfully, "according to our audio relay, it looks as if our fleet is going to win this time." "Yes," Tony agreed, not understanding. "My father says we didn't build up adequate supply bases. We'll probably have to fall back too." And then the impact hit him. "You mean for the first time in 100 years? "Yes," Liar said, also getting up. The others got up, too. They moved away from Tony toward the nearby house. "We're winning. The Terran flank was turned 30 minutes ago. Your right wing has folded completely." Tony was stunned. "And it matters. It matters to all of you?" "Matters?" Prith halted, suddenly blazing out in fury. "Sure it matters. For the first time in a century, the first time in our lives, we're beating you. We have you on the run. You," he choked out the word, almost spat it out, "you white grubs." They disappeared into the house. Tony sat gazing stupidly down at the ground, his hands still moving aimlessly. He had heard the word before, seen it scrawled on walls and in the dust near the settlement. White grubs, the past term for derision for Terrans. Because of their softness, their whiteness, lack of hard shells, pulpy, doughy skin. But they had never dared say it out loud before, to an Earthman's face. Beside him, his Eep stirred restlessly. Its intricate radio mechanism sensed the hostile atmosphere. Automatic relays were sliding into place. Circuits were opening and closing. "It's all right," Tony murmured, getting slowly up. "Maybe we better get back." He moved unsteadily toward the ramp, completely shaken. The Eep walked calmly ahead, its metal face blank and confident, feeling nothing, saying nothing. Tony's thoughts were a wild turmoil. He shook his head, but the crazy spinning kept up. He couldn't make his mind slow down, lock in place. "Wait a minute," a voice said. Bepritz's voice, from the open doorway, cold and withdrawn, almost unfamiliar. "What do you want?" Bepritz came toward him, claws behind his back in the formal Pasudeti posture used between total strangers. "You shouldn't have come here today." "I know," Tony said. Bepritz got out a bit of his tistock and began to roll it into a tube. He pretended to concentrate on it. "Look," he said. "You said you have a right to be here, but you don't." "I," Tony murmured, "do you understand why not? You said it isn't your fault. I guess not. But it's not my fault either. Maybe it's nobody's fault. I've known you a long time."
5 years, Taryn.
But Prith twisted the stalk up and tossed it away. "Yesterday we played together. We worked on the spaceport, but we can't play today. My family said to tell you not to come here anymore." He hesitated and did not look Tony in the face. "I was going to tell you anyhow before they said anything."
"Oh," Tony said.
"Everything that's happened today, the battle, our fleet's stand, we didn't know. We didn't dare hope, you see. A century of running. First the system, then the Rigel system, all the planets, then the other Orion stars. We fought here and there, scattered fights. Those that got away joined up. We supplied the base at Orion. You people didn't know. But there was hope, no hope, at least. Nobody thought there was." He was silent a moment. "Funny," he said. "What happens when your back's to the wall and there isn't any further place to go? Then you have to fight."
"If our supply bases," Tony began thickly, but Prith cut him off savagely.
"Your supply bases, don't you understand? We're beating you. Now you'll have to get out, all you white grubs, out of our system."
Tony's eep moved forward ominously, but Prith saw it. He bent down, snatched up a rock, and hurled it straight at the eep. The rock clanged off the metal hull and bounced harmlessly away. But Prith snatched up another rock. Lyre and the others came quickly out of the house. An adult pass loomed up behind them. Everything was happening too fast. More rocks crashed against the eep. One struck Tony on the arm.
"Get out," Biprith screamed. "Don't come back. This is our planet."
His claws snatched at Tony.
"We'll tear you to pieces if you..."
Tony smashed him in the chest. The soft shell gave like rubber and the pass stumbled back. He wobbled and fell over, gasping and screeching.
"Beetle," Tony breathed hoarsely. Suddenly he was terrified. A crowd of Pasudetti was forming rapidly. They surged on all sides, hostile faces, dark and angry, a rising thunder of rage. More stones showered. Some struck the eep. Others fell around Tony near his boots. One whizzed past his face. Quickly, he slid his helmet in place. He was scared. He knew his eep's e-signal had already gone out, but it would be minutes before a ship could come. Besides, there were other Earthmen in the city to be taken care of. There were Earthmen all over the planet, in all of the cities, on all the 23 Betelgeuse planets, on the 14 Rigel planets, on the other Orion planets.
"We have to get out of here," he muttered to the eep.
"Do something."
A stone hit him on the helmet. The plastic cracked. Air leaked out. And then the autoseal filmed over. More stones were falling. The pass swarmed close, a yelling, seething mass of black-sheathed creatures. He could smell them, the acrid body odor of insects, hear their claws snap, feel their weight. The eep threw its heat beam on. The beam shifted in a wide band toward the crowd of Pasudetti. Crude hand weapons appeared. A clatter of bullets burst around Tony. They were firing at the eep. He was dimly aware of the metal body beside him. A shuddering crash. The eep was toppled over. The crowd poured over it. The metal hull was lost from sight. Like a demented animal, the crowd tore at the struggling eep. A few of them smashed in its head. Others tore off struts and shiny arm sections. The eep ceased struggling. The crowd moved away, panting and clutching jagged remains. They saw Tony. As the first line of them reached for him, the protective envelope high above them shattered. A Terran ship, A Terran scout ship thundered down, heat beam screaming. The crowd scattered in confusion, some firing, some throwing stones, others leaping for safety. Tony picked himself up and made his way unsteadily toward the spot where the scout was landing.
"I'm sorry,"
Joe Rossi said gently. He touched his son on the shoulder.
"I shouldn't have let you go down there today. I should have known."
Tony sat hunched over in the big plastic easy chair. He rocked back and forth, face pale with shock. The scout ship which had rescued him had immediately headed back toward Carnet. There were other Earthmen to bring out besides this first load. The boy said nothing. His mind was blank. He still heard the roar of the crowd, felt its hate. A century of pent-up fury and resentment. The memory drove out everything else. It was all around him, even now. And the sight of the floundering EEP, the metallic ripping sound as its arms and legs were torn off and carried away. His mother dabbed at his cuts and scratches with antiseptic. Joe Rossi shakily lit a cigarette and said, "If your EEP hadn't been along, they'd have killed you. Beatles," he shuddered. "I never should have let you go down there all this time. They might have done it any time, any day. Knifed you. Cut you open with their filthy god claws." Below the settlement, the reddish-yellow sunlight glinted on gun barrels. Already dull booms echoed against the crumbling hills. The defense ring was going into action. Black shapes darted and scurried up the side of the slope. Black patches moved out from Carnet toward the Terran settlement. Across the dividing line the Confederation surveyors had set up a century ago. Carnet was a bubbling pot of activity. The whole city rumbled with feverish excitement. Tony raised his head. They turned our flank.
Yeah, Joe Rossi stubbed out his cigarette. They sure did. That was at 1 o'clock. At 2, they drove a wedge right through the center of our line, split the fleet in half, broke it up, sent it running, picked us off one by one as we fell back. Christ, they're like maniacs. Now that they've got the scent, the taste of our blood.
But it's getting better, Leia fluttered. Our main fleet units are beginning to appear.
We'll get them, Joe muttered. It'll take a while, but by God, we'll wipe them out, every last one of them. If it takes 1,000 years, we'll follow every last ship down. We'll get them all.
His voice rose in frenzy.
Beetles, insects, when I think of them trying to hurt my kid with their filthy black claws.
If you were younger, you'd be in the line, Leia said. It's not your fault you're too old. The heart strain's too great. You did your job. They can't let an older person take chances. It's not your fault.
Joe clenched his fists. I feel so futile. If there was only something I could do.
The fleet will take care of them, Leia said soothingly. You said so yourself. They'll hunt every one of them down, destroy them all. There's nothing to worry about.
Joe sagged miserably. It's no use. Let's cut it out. Let's stop kidding ourselves.
What do you mean?
Face it, we're not going to win. Not this time. We went too far. Our time's come.
There was silence. Tony sat up a little.
When did you know? I've known a long time.
I found out today. I didn't understand at first. This is stolen ground. I was born here, but it's stolen ground.
Yes, it's stolen. It doesn't belong to us.
We're here because we're stronger, but now we're not stronger. We're being beaten.
They know Terrans can be licked, like anybody else.
Joe Rossi's face was gray and flabby. We took their planets away from them. Now they're taking them back.
It'll be a while, of course. We'll retreat slowly. It'll be another 5 centuries going back.
There are a lot of systems around here, between here and Sol. Tony shook his head, still uncomprehending. even Lyre and Bepreth, all of them, waiting for their term to come. Waiting for their time to come, for us to lose and go away again, where we came from. Joe Rossi paces back and forth. We'll be retreating from now on, giving ground instead of taking it. It'll be like this today, losing fights, draws, stalemates, and worse. He raised his feverish eyes toward the ceiling of the little metal housing unit, face wild with passion and misery. But by God, we'll give them a run for their money, all the way back, every inch. Now I'm going to show you some what they call flash fiction. It's a story under 100 words that happens quickly. No story goes over 5 minutes, so I might get a few in. These are all done by a woman named Allison Spooner. The first one is Time to Go Home. The first night I had a real conversation with Professor Garrison was the last night I saw him. Every college town has a staple drunk. They pay rent at a bar stool, drinking away whatever leads an aging man to drink bottom shelf scotch, surrounded by college kids. Ours was Professor Garrison. 60-something, well-dressed, but usually crumpled-looking. He was quirky to the point of crazy. Even before a few drinks, he entered the bar mumbling about being lost and getting home. And even though we called him Professor, no one was sure he really was. It was how he'd introduced himself when he'd first wandered in, looking over a newspaper, shaking his head, swearing and mumbling something about incorrect calibrations. But no one I knew had ever had a class with him. He thought it was amusing to ask people to arm wrestle and then reveal his biomechanical arm. Even though he found it funny, we all knew not to ask about it. It was unlike anything any of us had ever seen, and even the medical and engineering students puzzled over its mechanics. "It's just not possible," someone had once whispered, loudly, across the bar. Professor Garrison didn't respond, but he did give a chuckle, throw back the rest of his scotch, and mumble to no one in particular, "All in good time." The only thing we knew was that he'd lost his right arm before he started college. Maybe we should have been more concerned about his mental health, considering he seemed sure he was in the wrong year. But he never bothered anyone. He showed up every night, thick black glasses, messy shoulder-length gray hair, talking about being lost. And I took pity and served him. But tonight, Professor Garrison showed no interest in drinking. Approaching the bar in a perfectly pressed suit, his hair pulled back and smooth, he shook his head before I could grab a glass. "Not tonight. It's time for me to go back where I came from." "Oh, yeah? So you're not from around here?" It was amazing how little we knew about him. "Not really. I've been stuck, but I finally found someone to help fix my ride." "Oh?" A group of new freshmen pushed through the door and I rolled my eyes, ready to confiscate their fake IDs. "Who?" The professor pointed at the group and my eyes fell on a scrawny kid with thick black glasses, hair down to his shoulders, and a bandage wrapped around a stub of an arm cut off at the elbow. "Me." The angels inside me. Tonight I stop fighting with the angels inside me. Tonight I will answer their call. Sitting cross-legged on the desert floor, my hands resting on top of my knees, I watch and shiver as the last of the daylight dips into the distant abyss and sucks the last of the heat with it. As it does, the final ray catches the only object for miles that could reflect its offering. There is a glint, like a wink from a wise man, who is the only one who knows what's coming next, and the steel of the weapon in front of me laughs as though it can see the future. I don't remember the exact moment I ran out of fight. I'd spent the last 12 hours dragging my feet through the sands of the desert, convinced I was strong. I knew from the beginning it was futile, but I pushed on, feigning a faith in my own strength. But I was a fool, like most men are when up against the kind of foe I was fighting. You never win against angels, no matter how strong your faith. When they dropped me off in this godforsaken desert, I told myself I was strong. I stood, watching the dust settle and cover the tire tracks of the jeep as it turned into a black speck on the horizon, already fighting my losing battle. I felt the call immediately, even as the last of the disturbed sand was falling onto my eyelashes and into the tan ocean surrounding me. I heard it, and I answered. "I'll fight it," I told the desert. "You lose." When they were gone, I set off into the nothingness. I had nothing in my possession except the clothes they had dressed me in, and banging against my thigh as I walked, a gun stuffed into the side pocket of my cargo pants. I hadn't gotten my command yet. The angels hadn't yet told me what they wanted me to do, but the rhythmic beating against my leg gave me an idea. "I know what you want, and you won't get it." The deafening silence of the desert was the only response. Even though there was no answer, I knew it was only a matter of time before the call got louder, my resistance would weaken, and I would be ready to receive the command. That's what always happened to the others. We had watched them all, my colleagues and I, one by one, hear the call, get the command, and immediately insist there was no way they would comply. And then they did. They always did. "Like you will." "I'll fight it." "You'll lose." It was always the same. The call primed them. The subtle signal told them to expect a command. They became susceptible, but not submissive. "Not yet." "Sure, we'll do what you ask if we want to." Their attitudes were always the same, until the next step. We watched from the other side of the one-way glass as their eyes narrowed and the order echoed inside their heads. Sometimes they would scoff. Sometimes they would shake their heads. Some fought harder and longer than others, but they always completed the order. The day I voiced my concern was the day we decided to take the experiments to the next level. The requests had been simple until then, mostly innocent. "Use that hammer to bust a hole in the wall. Take off all your clothes and walk into the hall." They weren't satisfied. They needed to know exactly what we had created and exactly what it was capable of. Otherwise, what was the point? But I was finally starting to feel some remorse, a sickening as I thought of the moral ramifications of what we were doing. "How far are you willing to push this?" I'd asked after a brainstorming session that turned the contents of my stomach cold. They turned to me, their eyes glazed over with crazed purpose. "Let's find out." The next day, I woke up with an aching head and blood seeping through the bandages that were covering fresh stitches. By the next day, I was alone in the desert fighting with the angels. It was a short fight. I remember struggling, but I don't remember why. We designed the angels to be invincible, even against their creator. State of the art, but highly illegal. The acting neurograft exo-learning software started as a challenge. Could we do it? We were the best and the brightest in the programming department, but we weren't authorized to work on mind control devices, so we did it in secret. My doubts were only impairing the ability of my teammates to create a device that could change the world. I know that now. I learned that when I stopped fighting. Or maybe I always knew. It's hard to tell. Now I have heard the call. I have received the command. I must surrender. The stars sparkle overhead in goosebumps erupt on my arm as my fingers close around the cold metal of the gun in front of me. There's only one bullet in the chamber. It's all you need. I tried to fight. You lost. I lift my hand and the cool metal kisses my temple. The final light. She paused and looked around the quiet stretch of land dotted with the proof of life once lived. No one else had chosen this spot for this night, and she supposed that made sense. But for her, the line separating the living and the dead had always been thin, and they were getting thinner with each passing moment. She'd long preferred the company of the dead anyway. Why should now be any different? Her final spot chosen, she turned and watched for his approaching figure. He'd been close behind the whole walk here, but she couldn't make out his frame in the last of the light. The very last of it, actually. She chuckled at the thought. He should have caught up by now. She called into the falling darkness. Nothing. Her skin prickled, but she refused to let herself panic. There was still time. Let him enjoy himself. That was the whole point of their meeting, after all. Comfort, enjoyment. The rest of the world had paired off immediately after the announcement, contacting loved ones, holing up with families, or running off to be with friends. But 10 years as a coroner's assistant had given her a certain aversion to the living. After the announcement, she'd had no one to turn to for comfort until she saw him. He was alone, too, and his deep brown eyes caught her attention immediately. He shouldn't have to spend this time alone, and neither should she. They'd gone home together. She turned again, squinting through the now complete darkness. She said his name, then again louder. "Caesar, come here, boy." Only silence answered her call, and her stomach clenched. It was getting close, and she was suddenly very aware of how badly she did not want to be alone. It was why she'd been drawn to him on the street, why she'd chosen this place for their last moments. "Caesar." She looked up to the sky. The moon shone neon bright, catching the stones around her and bouncing back into the charged atmosphere. Then the light was gone. It was here. She fell to her knees in the pitch-black night, the last night, and reached out into the nothingness around her. She called again, one last time. A bark, soft fur brushed her hands, a cold nose pressed against her cheek. Her arms closed around his solid form, and he sighed against her as the meteor met the earth, and the last darkness met the final light. The Lender. The light from the window washes over me as I observe the nightly routine of the house, waiting for the right moment. It would have to be soon. They are settling in for the night, the child already tucked safely into bed. The female shuffles around the kitchen in her slippers preparing tea, but the male, he is waiting too. He paces the living room, glancing at the door, then the window. The rough October winds rattle their window panes, and he jumps at every creak, every scratch of a branch across the glass. The female comes into the room and touches her uneasy husband's shoulder. Another gust of wind shakes the tree I wait under, and an indignant owl voices his annoyance. I step into the soft beam of the front porch light and push open the door. The couple jumps at the sound, and soon they appear in the hall, the man in front of his wife, his arm shielding her from the harm he knows is coming. Before either of them can speak, I proceed. I am here to collect. Collect? Who the hell? Her husband cuts her off. You can't have him. It was part of our deal, sir. I most certainly can. Deal? Her voice is shrill, panic rising as she watches me approach the stairs. What deal? He's trying to take Danny. He steps in front of the staircase. He's nothing more than a thief.
Sir, I keep my voice low, but he jumps anyway. I am no thief. I am a lender. I am simply taking back what is rightfully mine. I put my hand on his shoulder, my long fingers reaching his back. You will give me my property. He is not property. He is my son. I sigh. They never believe I will return. 10 years ago, you made a deal. In your desperation for a child, you asked for help. I delivered a child on loan. That loan has expired. It is time to repay it. The woman gasps and then sobs. He hadn't told her of the deal. Never mind, though. They would not remember this exchange in the morning. I push past the man, and despite being a head shorter than he can't stop me. He falls to the ground, and the woman collapses next to him. They stare after me, already grieving. They will wake up in their beds tomorrow, convinced a mysterious illness has taken their child, and that I was nothing more than the freaky-fingered hand of death that took him. They will remember grief, they will remember fear, but they will not remember me. Letting go. I think you know what's best right now. He sighed at the doctor's statement, and I could hear the tears clogging his throat when he spoke next. That machine says she's still breathing. Still breathing, yes, but all the tests show there is no more brain activity. How can that be? She was fine a week ago. Maybe we should give it a little more time, I said. I could tell how upset he was, could hear the quiver in his voice. He wasn't ready to let go. When the brain is denied oxygen for too long, there isn't much that can be done to bring it back. Maybe there's a chance, I tried, but the doctor continued. The stroke ruptured a blood vessel that was carrying oxygen to her brain. If we catch it soon enough, sometimes we can do something, but in this case... He choked on a sob. I should have been there. She was all alone. I wanted to reach out and hold him, to stroke his hair and tell him it would all be okay. Instead, I said, he needs more time. The doctor's feet moved toward the bed, his heels clicking on the tile as he read the machines, mumbling under his breath as the man next to him sniffled and tried to regain his composure. I said he's not ready. Can't you give him some more time? You're absolutely sure there's nothing else you can do? He asks shakily. We've done everything we can. Her vitals haven't changed in 48 hours. Honey, if you need more time, don't let him rush you. I was trying to keep my voice calm yet firm, but no one acknowledged me. The springs of his chair squeaked as he stood and his footsteps approached the bed. Somehow, he whispered, I already miss her, even though she's right in front of me. Listen to me, I finally raised my voice. We can get a second opinion. We can run more tests. If you're not ready to say goodbye, we don't have to listen to this guy. I loved that he was so trusting, but I'd always been the one to make deals and stand firm when the cable company tried to swindle us. I'd always been able to command the attention of a whole room or any individual. Debate, public speaking, theater. I was not used to being ignored. But instead of turning to me, the question of what to do next, dancing in his sweet brown eyes, my husband again addressed the doctor. What should I do? I think you know, he said, again opening the decision up to the grieving man before him without actually answering. He sighed and swallowed another sob. But she's right here. She's right in front of me, and you're telling me it's time to let her go? It's not time, I practically shouted. Why aren't you listening to me? Her body is here, her blood is flowing, and her heart is pumping because of the machines. The woman in that body, your wife is gone. His wife? No, I screamed, but no one moved, and then, like a movie playing in reverse, my senses began to catch up.
He was reaching out to touch my hand, but I couldn't reach back. My hands, my arm, both were attached to the bed with an invisible strap. My head wouldn't lift, my feet wouldn't kick, and then I noticed the dark. I couldn't see my husband or the doctor. I could see his movements, as I had every day for the last 10 years, dance across the back of my eyelids, but I couldn't open my eyes to catch his gaze. I could picture him standing from his chair and moving toward my bed, just as he had after my bout with appendicitis, but I hadn't actually witnessed it. I knew he would rub one hand over the stubble growing across his chin and cheeks after days by my side, begging me to wake up and look at him. But I couldn't see the coarse, wrinkled fingers ball into a fist as his frustration grew. The movie continued to reverse, and the hospital faded to our kitchen where I stood less than a week ago, on tiptoes, reaching into the pantry for the last can of dog food, while our schnauzer waited not so patiently, and I cursed at her while I reached. And then I couldn't remember what I was reaching for, and the ground was rising up, and the arm that I threw out to catch myself proved useless, and I crumpled into a heap next to Sadie. She barked and barked for help, trying to tell someone, anyone, that there was danger, but there was no one to hear her. He was late. I was alone as the kitchen and the barking and the world faded around me. I felt him next to me. I could hear him sniffling. I could hear them talking, debating over the next moments of my life. The warmth of his chest pressed me into the bed, his cheek against my shoulder. His head lifted, and I felt him studying me. "I can't leave her now." He was looking for a response. I begged my body to answer, my lip to twitch, or my eyes to open. He touched my cheek, and I tried to scream, but my body wouldn't listen to me, and I could feel him sag under the weight of my stillness. His thumb swept across my cheek as the pressure of his chest lifted. He sobbed again. "She's already gone." I'm not gone. I'm still here." "I'm sorry," the doctor said. He squeezed my hand. "I'm sorry," he whispered, kissing my cheek. I screamed harder. He still held my hand. I begged my limbs to work. I squeezed. He gasped, "Wait!"